Welcome to Zuma JD interview number 6. If you're new to the show, I'm Zuma JD. Every now and then I interview a great guest from the world of crypto. We like to keep our conversations relaxed, talking about the latest in markets and economics. So let's get into it. Suzu, welcome to your Zuma JD interview.
Hey John, thanks for having me.
First of all, it'd be really great if you could introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Three Arrows as well.
I'm based in Singapore, born in China, grew up in the US a bit as well. Three Arrows is basically a crypto hedge fund. We started out as an FX macro fund, and now we do more, pretty much all crypto. We do longer term investing, passive investing, as well as market neutral strategies that are basically doing basis trading. So we're pretty active on all the perpetual swap exchanges, futures exchanges. And recently we're very active in DeFi as well.
And how did you get into crypto yourself?
I first came across it pretty early, maybe late 2012, early 13, just seeing it used in Hong Kong and Macau for cross-border transfers and things like that. And I think at that time, I was not really sort of positioned to be a crypto true believer in that sense, or Bitcoin at that time. Didn't really grasp the philosophical implications at that time, but was more interested from a trading point of view, just the arbitrage between exchanges, things like that. So I dabbled a decent amount doing those trades. And we were actually starting Three Arrows at that time to take advantage of some opportunities in the emerging market foreign exchange. So as that kind of took off for us, I kept crypto more as a hobby and looking at it as a side thing at that time. But I was still probably the largest open interest on some of the futures exchanges that were around at that time. And then I had some bad experiences with a couple of them. So that kind of made me shy away as well at that time. We recently got back into it a few years ago, where there's a lot of opportunities that we saw coming back in the markets, and so it's been a long journey. I think I've been humbled a lot by the markets, and I've learned a lot as well.
Yeah, interesting. So would you say you just said before that initially you weren't really interested in the philosophical stuff? Are you more interested in that now, or do you still mainly see this as just a way to make money?
Yeah, I'm definitely much more of a true believer than I was before. I think seeing Bitcoin as the true digital scarcity that everyone collects, I think that's very powerful these days, and I relate a lot with that. I also think that sort of the more Ethereum-based vision of positive sum, programmable money kind of vision, I also am increasingly more of a believer in as well. I think that it has a lot of potential to disintermediate the way the internet works things like that. So definitely much more of a true believer than I was when I first heard about it. And
that makes sense, because I was going to say I really find it hard to believe that you weren't more of a true believer given how active you are on Twitter, and your knowledge is very strong about a lot of the projects, even the smaller ones. And at least in my experience, it's pretty hard to, follow everything passionately unless you're interested in more than just the money-making opportunity.
Yeah. Like, I think I first bought Bitcoin to trade it around when it was around $5. So I think if I compute my net worth then versus now, I'm probably still down quite a bit in sats versus if I just bought all Bitcoin and then went on vacation. So it's it's the kind of thing that I do a lot more philosophy now and first principles now because of having that experience also.
So just to play around with this idea a little bit more, because you started off in traditional finance and then have done more and more crypto trading, are you mostly attracted to some of the philosophical ideas behind cryptocurrency due to limitations of the traditional finance space? Or is it more just the new things that cryptocurrency allow?
I think it's both. So the traditional finance space has a lot of gatekeepers and a lot of intermediation of buyers and sellers, clients and dealers. So it creates this upper class of people that are there to primarily profit from financial activities. And Peter Thiel has this concept of the over-financialization of the economy, where he points out that, you know, after World War II, people all wanted to be engineers. And then, you know, at some point, you know, going into 2008, 40% of all Ivy League graduates were going to investment banks to try to figure out how to make money with more money, things like that. So I see crypto as a big step away from that and back toward, you know, what do you actually need to have a working financial system? What do you actually need to have working money? And you probably will see fewer people working in finance, as it were, but much more that everyone is involved to some extent, smoother experience for everyone. And you know, the smartest minds of our generations can be working on engineering again, as opposed to...
Yeah, that's a really good point. I never thought about it that way, actually. I'm a big Peter Thiel fan as well. Yeah, that's a good point. It's kind of like you get the best of the finance world in the sense that you can make a lot of money. You can kind of travel the world, I guess. And, you know, if you have a finance background, you can apply a lot of your knowledge in this new space. But the crypto space is, especially the Ethereum stuff, is an engineering project. Yeah, that's a cool way of looking at it. At the moment, cryptocurrencies seem to be correlated with stocks. So this is a different topic now. But do you have any thoughts about why they're correlated and how long this correlation has been there, how long it'll stay? I'm really curious for your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think there's clear correlation between risk assets and risk off assets. And right now, Bitcoin, crypto in general, is still trading very much as a risk asset whenever there's really big issues with liquidity where people need to reduce the things in their portfolio that are fluctuating relative to their spending basket, then they'll tend to sell crypto, they'll tend to sell stocks. So conversely, it benefits from the money printing and it benefits from the quantitative easing because that increases the money supply, increases people's confidence in assets going up. So I think that correlation is, it does have some fundamental basis. But I think that even though there's correlation, there's a lot of secular bull runs that can happen while things are correlated. So, I mean, it generally correlates a lot with gold now as well, right? I think correlation with gold is near all-time highs.
Well, I was thinking it'd be cool if essentially crypto, like Bitcoin in particular, just correlates with it, whatever's going up. So usually stocks and gold are inverse, so that'd be fun if we just went up with stocks and then went up with gold as well. But
yeah, exactly. And Bitcoin has tended to do that, right? Where it correlates with stuff as it goes up, but then when stuff goes down and other stuff goes up, it chooses a new one. You saw that in 2015 where it went up a lot for a while with Chinese stocks going up. And then Chinese stocks tanked and the CNH, the Chinese currency weakened a lot and gold went up. And then Bitcoin went up with that as well. So it was kind of, ultimately it's narrative, right? Because it's still so early for crypto, the number of users, number of holders relative to the mainstream markets is so low that people, you know, it's kind of, any publicity is good publicity. When people hear about it and they want to get involved, that can come from it decoupling from traditional markets. It can also become from going up faster when traditional markets are going up. So it kind of benefits from all volatility. I think the worst is when nothing's moving and then people just get tired of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you have an opinion on whether Bitcoin is going to maintain this correlation?
I think if stocks fall a lot from here, Bitcoin will not be immune, but it will based on its own technicals and based on its own supply and demand. So if stocks go much lower, that doesn't mean Bitcoin has to go, let's say, way below 7 or 8K, for instance. I think ultimately it's still cordoned off enough that you won't have these kind of one-to-one correlations like you see in FX markets. On the way up, though, I think it will outperform stocks massively because of the fact that it will eat up a lot of the speculative capital in the space, as well as the reflexivity of the fact that it will likely outperform stocks quite a bit on the way up. So people will see it as like a levered play on stocks. I was speaking with a macro guy the other day, and he's saying how, they're very heavily allocated toward BTC to the point where they see it as a superset of stocks. They see it as there's no point owning stocks because it'll almost certainly outperform stocks on the upside. And on the downside, it may be protected as well because of how far we still are from all-time highs. So I think that narrative is actually quite popular in the macro space at the moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear. I personally don't really trade stocks. So I'd never really considered whether there was a correlation or how important it was until this year, just because it was so obvious in March what happened. I was really kind of naive. Maybe a dumb retail take I had was that I thought if stocks crashed that Bitcoin would go up. But obviously in March, that isn't what happened. And then they've been kind of correlated. And then as well, I also kind of thought that maybe that indicated, and I've seen a few people say this as well, that it indicates that there's a lot of institutional money in crypto, maybe more than we thought. And essentially when stocks go down, they pile out of risky assets like crypto. But yeah, what you've just said kind of indicates that maybe that isn't really the main thing going on here.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of all that, right? The bigger it gets, the more it has to correlate with things because it's sort of the macro convergence, right? It has to, if it's an asset that's relevant to people, then it will also correlate with other things that are relevant to people. If that, just a matter of how far away we are from that and how much drift up we have left, right? So throughout that correlation, you'll still have this natural drift higher because the whole space will be growing. And that kind of is the wind that blows it forward. At some point, if it's already reached the size that it will grow to, then it may, the super normal, extra normal returns may be gone that period. But it'll trade much more like a safe haven asset, or it'll trade much more like just another global currency. But I think we're quite far from that, where those kind of discussions are more relevant.
Yeah. My position has always been that if you look at the market cap and volumes that are traded in Bitcoin, obviously we're not at an all-time high for market cap. Volumes are pretty decent at the moment, but if it's going to be an asset class that a lot of people are in and it's really serious, it still has to grow a hell of a lot. So another topic, hot topic at the moment is DeFi. Do you think that DeFi is over, or is this just like the end of the first chapter with the dumping at the moment?
It's definitely not over. It's the first chapter for sure. I think the DeFi concept has always been around as something that the space wants to work toward, but only recently has it been possible to actually have that confluence of users, reasonable projects that people want to use, and the layer one being able to support that activity, right? So I think that if anything, it's fulfilling a multi-year vision that the space has had. I mean, Maker, some of these other, So I think DeFi is a very important part of the crypto story. It is talking about how we can bridge two sides of liquidity, the taker and the maker, or the borrower and the lender. How we can bridge those in an efficient way, in an incentivized way that reduces friction, reduces middlemen. And I think that that's really powerful. And I do think that we're just in the beginning of what's possible with that. I think a year ago I tweeted about, what would a decentralized BitMEX look like? And recently we've invested in a few projects that are trying to go toward that vision. And I think, most of those haven't even launched yet. They're soon to launch. And the user experiences of all of those will be varying, and their approaches are all different from scaling to how they build liquidity. But I think that a lot of the workflows that we take for granted as requiring centralized finance, I do think that they're better in a DeFi environment. I mean, just think about the demand for people to trade on Uniswap. Uniswap legitimately is a very mediocre user experience, right? You can't even place limit orders. You can't do a lot of things that you take for granted. People do it because, they can just, they're on their web wallet, they're on their browser, and they can put through trades. They don't have to deposit withdrawal. They don't have to do KYC. They don't have to send selfies to anyone. And I think that all that kind of stuff, people do value. I don't think it'll kill centralized finance completely, but I do think that it'll enable a lot of cool stuff that people haven't really thought about being possible yet. So.
Do you think it can't kill centralized finance completely because of technological problems, or there's certain things that actually make sense to do in a centralized way?
There are certain things that make sense to centralize. And also I think centralized exchanges, they have acquired a lot of customers. So their customer acquisition is valuable in itself. And what you'll tend to see, I think, as DeFi grows is that centralized exchanges will offer bridges into DeFi. So basically offer a dumbed down experience to get DeFi-like returns or DeFi strategies without having to go do DeFi themselves. Some people will prefer that because they like to be coddled or they like to have a more centralized experience.
Yeah, you can't really have like a decentralized relationship manager or something if that's something that you want.
Exactly. So I imagine DeFi being kind of the wholesale market or the underlying market. And then there will still be company services that build on top of that and offer branded, offer bespoke experiences that are all ultimately hedging into that market. But I think the key difference is that the main sources of liquidity can end up being on DEXs, on decentralized protocols, as opposed to sitting in centralized ones. And I think that scares a lot of centralized exchanges, right? You're seeing massive outflows of Ether into DeFi. You're seeing massive outflows of USDT, USDC into DeFi, as opposed to sitting on exchanges. So I think that's why you've seen all the spot exchanges try to rush to offer DeFi tokens, DeFi trading, because they don't want money to flow out irreversibly to DeFi. So.
Yeah, it's really interesting to watch. I'm so happy about Uniswap. Like it's just recharged my interest in the space, and it just makes me really excited again, because I feel like we were definitely going through a period where a lot of the centralized platforms were probably getting a little bit comfortable going, you know, the future is all KYC, the future is all centralized, you know, the Wild West days are done, or there might be little Wild West things that pop up, but they'll get crushed very quickly. And then, you know, Uniswap rocks up on the scene and just blows up out of control, and it's a genuine threat, I think. Even just things like the whole liquidity pool thing and automated market making, even with the limitations of impermanent loss and things like this, it's still a very popular thing. And there's professional actors who are taking advantage of this and making money. So yeah, it's all working really well.
All these ideas are at the first inning as well, right? I mean, AMMs, the first one is so basic. It's, you know, just the constant, it's a constant function, but those are getting better and better over time. There's going to be privacy eventually on some of these that make it more usable as well for people. I think just in the first innings, the best ideas are not yet thought of yet when I think about DeFi. People haven't come up with them yet.
I'm really looking forward to cross-chain swap. Essentially, whoever figures out how to do a Uniswap for Bitcoin to USDC or USDT or Bitcoin to Ethereum or whatever, I think that will be super, super interesting to see, rather than having to wrap your Bitcoin and all that. I noticed before you mentioned that one of the reasons why DeFi is kind of popping off now is like the infrastructure's there on Ethereum side, so that the L1 infrastructure is good. Do you think that Ethereum actually has significantly improved?
That's a tough question. I think in some ways it's improved. Some ways it really hasn't. I think on the improvement side, it's more just that it benefits from the rails that were already built from the ICO wave, because everyone knows how to use MetaMask for the most part. It's relatively easy to use. A lot of the tooling is already there, and the developer education is quite streamlined now. People can get up and running in a few weeks. So I think that the barriers to entry for both users and developers are the lowest in the space, and that infrastructure is really valuable. In terms of the actual way that transactions get handled or the congestion, these kinds of things, obviously it's still a long ways to go. ETH2 is still a long ways to go. I think that does give space for competitors to offer better stuff. I think that, you know, we're publicly quite bullish on Polkadot as a sort of the protocols being able to do a lot of interesting things. Where I think Ethereum's security model is quite obviously tied to, at the moment, a more Bitcoin-like model, which is that you want higher fees and you want fees to pay for security. Whereas I think some of the other chains where the idea is that your application doesn't, the transaction fees are not what's paying for the security. There's some other bonding or some other concept that's paying for it. And so transactions could be near free for each application chain. And then they would also have sovereignty over how they deploy, right? I mean, imagine on Ethereum, if you had an idea a few months ago and then you deploy into a 500 GUI transaction environment, you can't do anything. And even if fees go down again to 70 or 80 GUI, you still don't know what it'll be like in next month. So yeah. I think the whole idea of applications having to compete for block space, I think is quite flawed as a as an architecture of a Web3. So I do think that there's a lot of good layer ones that are coming out now. I think Polkadot being one, but I also think Solana, their approach is interesting. It's it's hard to reason about the centralization of validator sets right now for the market, but I think I think all these approaches are interesting and worth doing because Ethereum will have a lot of the assets sitting on it because ERC-20 is a very strong network effect from the fact that exchanges can already support it seamlessly to the fact that it's everyone knows how to interact with it. But I think in terms of how applications get built and how, the best applications in the future get built, that's still wide open. And I don't think Ethereum has won that by any means.
I would think that the network effect that Ethereum enjoys probably isn't as strong as Ethereum fans think. I think like the ERC-20 thing is good. And then obviously all the exchanges supporting that is definitely an important thing. But as we're seeing, like if you have a great decentralized offering that anyone can hook up to pretty quickly, then I think it'd be quite easy to take away market share from Ethereum. Like how quickly, say if we see this DeFi interest resume, as in interest in all these interesting little platforms and such increase again, and it kind of picks up where it left off a week or so ago. On what timeline do you think you could see Solana, Polkadot, and other more readily scalable Ethereum competitors actually start taking significant market share?
I think it can be quite fast, right? Because DeFi itself on Ethereum has been quite fast.
Yeah.
So I think there's no reason to... So I think users ultimately are chain agnostic. There's no concept to me of like Ethereum maximalism. I think it makes no sense because it's about users, right? It's about what you can build. I think Bitcoin monetary maximalism is a bit different because you're trying to say that this is the likely convergence of crypto monies onto a single money, right? Whereas for technology, I don't think the user should even know or care what chain he's using. It should be about like, is the overall product or is the overall use correct or is it useful, right? So, right now it is the most useful to interact with assets on Ethereum, and the ERC-20 network effect, is the reason why it succeeded and others have failed, right? There's, even though an EOS DEX might be fast, there's no assets you want to trade on EOS or even some of the other chains. So if, like you mentioned, cross-chain, all these kind of things, that opens up more space. So
yeah, I think another thing as well, I don't know how much of a factor this will play into things, but another benefit could be if, once again, like this DeFi thing resumes where it took off and the Ethereum price goes up again, and then you get chatter around Polkadot or Solana and whatever, if the underlying tokens for these platforms are significantly cheaper or the market caps are significantly lower, there's kind of like an early adopter incentive there, which could encourage people to try other blockchains. But
definitely,
I think it is a really good point though that you could kind of be a Bitcoin maximalist for the monetary side of things. It doesn't necessarily mean that you'd have to say that Ethereum is going to keep a stranglehold on the decentralized computing type of thing. Also, do you know, this might be a stupid question, but is it easy to port, say, a smart contract you've written for Ethereum over to Polkadot or Solana? Or do you have to write it from scratch?
Yeah, there's already a lot of ways that people anticipate those bridges happening, and you can deploy directly in Polkadot. There's a project called Moonbeam that's working on that in Polkadot. There's a few others too. I won't talk about the details of those. I think for Solana too, there's not a whole lot that people can see yet. But in theory, that's all possible for people to deploy. And I do think that's important because the developer resources are already on Ethereum. So being able to deploy over is ultimately is going to be valuable. I think in Polkadot, there was a big debate on this for a while where people thought that teams should just write in Rust and just deploy natively. And over time, you know, a lot of other teams stressed to them that you should offer Solidity deployments, you should offer direct from Ethereum deployments. And so now they have that. But yeah, it's kind of like JavaScript, right? Or it's kind of like, you know, languages that aren't very good, but people don't care because that's what everyone, it just works. So I think there is a lot of that too. And I think code quality on Ethereum has gotten better, right? I think the tools have gotten better. So even with all this DeFi stuff, I mean, if this had happened two years ago, everyone would have said there's going to be insane hacks, that there's going to be so many bugs, so many glitches. And thus far, it's generally okay, right? I mean, there was that Yams issue and there was a couple others, but it's not been anywhere near what naysayers would have said. So I think
there hasn't been like the DAO hack style incident.
Yeah. And I think that's a testament to how much better the development community is and how many good smart contract auditing firms there are and people thinking about these things. And also I think forking and then changing things is also healthy in a way too, because it's battle testing a lot of this code where we now know that these building blocks are good to be forked from. And so I think that all that is valuable, right? Whereas, you know, if you have an unaudited project on, say, Solana, and it was not from a fork of an existing code base that audited, I mean, you better really read that code yourself, right? Because there's absolutely no reason to assume that it's safe.
So I think this is a good point, actually. Yeah, that's quite a strong argument for Ethereum, you know, maintaining some dominance there. Like it's kind of a network effect it's more like the infrastructures there, people being able to check things, and people have been writing Solidity code for years and years now. Also, what I found really interesting about the DeFi thing, we were saying before about how it's kind of taken some centralized exchanges by surprise. I think one thing that I've found really surprising is how many of these Ethereum developers actually get financed properly. I feel like a few years ago, you get a lot of tech people who'd come in and try to build something on Ethereum, but they didn't really understand exactly what they were trying to do from a financial perspective. Whereas now what you see is people are building quite like complicated financial products and services on top of Ethereum, and the financial modeling, I guess, is actually sound now. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
100% agree. I think the type of talent that Ethereum is attracting now is quite a different style. It's people that want to really deploy stuff and see it work immediately, right? It's not really people who want to, let's say, have a very grandiose blockchain idea and do an ICO here and there. It's people that want to be able to see their code used. That naturally attracts a lot more pragmatic people, a lot more, you know, doers as opposed to sayers. So I think that's been one of the most bullish things for Ethereum, where, you know, with YFI, Andre, and some of these other projects, where it's given people a way to attract a community and talent by having good ideas and just deploying them. It's most close to the original cypherpunk vision.
One last question on Ethereum, and then we can move on to another topic. This was a community request on Twitter. Sure. Someone wanted me to ask you, what do you think about the fundamental value of Ethereum? So, for example, there's a concept that the true value locked up on Ethereum should not exceed Ethereum's market cap. Like, do you think that they're correlated?
On the question of the value that's locked up on it, or the value that's transacting on it versus value of each token itself, I don't think there's as strong of a tie there as people tend to think. I mean, if you think about Tron, right? There's a lot of USDT on Tron. I think it's much more than the market cap of Tron at this time. But that doesn't necessarily mean it has to converge to it. Because the security models are not necessarily based on just the market cap of the coin. I think it's kind of like one of those things that sounds correct, but it's not as on the strong of a backing. I think for token price itself and how it accrues value, I think it mainly accrues it from people using the network through future proposals, where the more transactions there are, the more ETH gets burned each time. I think that will create quite deflationary effects on Ether. I'm pretty bullish on that. I think there's quite wide community acceptance of that as well. It's just a matter of implementation. So it's a matter of when, not if. I think also from a monetary point of view, I wouldn't consider myself a full Bitcoin monetary maximalist. I do think Bitcoin will never be flippant in a real way from a monetary perspective, but I think that Ether can command some monetary premium as well as an alternative. I think you kind of see that already with, I mean, I think one of the reasons why Ether did so well in 2017 was not just the world computer thesis, but also that, you know, Bitcoin had the halving, it had the scaling debates, and it had the fork wars, and then a lot of Bitcoiners at that time migrated some assets to Ethereum because they thought, well, this is a very different approach, but it may lead to not a sound money per se, but a good money, right? So
yeah, I think that's definitely true. Kind of ironically, some people I think liked Ethereum more because it doesn't have the leadership issues that Bitcoin has. It's ironic because it's not as decentralized, at least in the sense that a lot of people put a lot of faith in Vitalik.
I think it was much more of an issue in the early days. I think now he stepped back from a lot of day to day, right? So I think there's a pretty distributed team of teams that are working on various issues. I do think Ethereum eventually needs to ossify a bit more and say, here's how it works, and have more, I think more formalized governance would not hurt it. I think there's clear splits in the past that probably didn't need to happen if they had better kind of ways to deal with things. And then that's probably my biggest gripe with Ethereum, right? And also why I think the Polkadot approach is interesting, because you just think about Parity, right? When they had their multi-sig bug and then ETH was stuck in that. So there are a lot of users that were just using that wallet, that there are a lot of users testing it, and Parity is, you know, it writes one of the two main node softwares, and it, you know, it would have been relatively trivial to have the next hard fork make those funds recoverable, right? And they had a carbon vote at that time, and it was quite close as well. And so for Parity, you know, they were saying, well, we already did the DAO rollback, right? So, you know, here we are, we have a slight bug that means that we can't access these ETH funds in the multi-sig wallet. Why wouldn't you just hard fork and let the users do it? These are some of the most passionate users on Ethereum, right? They're testing out new software. But like, that was a very tricky debate, and it was impossible to solve because Ethereum has no formal governance, but it, at the same time, it's not like Bitcoin. It does have to make hard decisions fairly often because stuff is happening on it in a faster pace, right? So it tries to adopt this Bitcoin stance when it suits some people, but then it tries to pretend it doesn't need more formal governance, but it ends up just having its own captured governance, right? Because obviously, if that wallet was run by maybe Consensus or run by someone else, that then maybe it would have been different, right? Like you don't know, because that's fundamentally, it's a power game, it's a politics game. I think these are the things that Ethereum will have to deal with at some point and figure out how do we reject or approve changes, right?
Yeah,
we saw that recently.
This is a big problem.
Yeah, I think one other point too that I think a lot of Bitcoiners underestimate is that the public, especially the new public that's joining the space now, they don't even really remember the space before Ethereum. That they don't understand what crypto would have been before Ethereum, because if they had dabbled in 2017, it would have been, you know, they maybe played with some ICOs or traded some tokens, but they don't even remember what the world was like before it was, you know, when it was just Bitcoin. So it's hard for them to imagine just Bitcoin again. So they don't have that reticence toward Ethereum that some of the more OGs in the space they tend to still
right. know.
So that all, I mean, it gives it a wind behind its back too, because people say, okay, Ethereum did very well in the previous cycle. now it's still around, still a lot of the innovation is happening on it. It gives it a natural legitimacy, I think.
So moving on from Ethereum, this has been a hell of a year. What are the kind of events that you're looking forward to, say, over the next 6 months to a year that you think are going to be really influential on shaping not only crypto, but also stocks and other asset classes?
I think the US election is by far the biggest event that's coming up. And secondarily, it would probably be just following the China-US escalations. I think that if Biden wins, it's going to be quite a knee-jerk down in most assets because his rhetoric has shifted quite left recently. But I also think that the way that U.S. politics works is that like everything comes back to the center, regardless of who gets elected. It's just irrelevant almost, right? So like people were selling stocks when Obama got elected, and then obviously that's a huge mistake. And then people were selling stocks when Trump got elected, thinking that, you know, Hillary would have been a more safe choice. And then, you know, stocks were limited down that day. And then Carl Icahn went on TV and said he was the most obvious buy of his life. And then stocks went up shitloads over the next few weeks. Yeah. So I think if Biden wins, probably a knee-jerk down, and then you just want to buy that, and then it goes up a shit ton again. I think Trump wins, it'll just go up a shit ton. I think stocks just are programmed to go up at this point, is the way that the society's been wired.
So you don't think, this is really interesting, all the stock stuff. As I said, I've never traded stocks. I was thinking about it in March when it really crashed. I was like, you know, if this is the time to get in, because I had been thinking before that it would be good to diversify and just buy some like Vanguard index, whatever type stuff. Ultimately didn't, because in hindsight, I'm starting to learn that, you know, a lot of the super pro Bitcoin stuff from retail people, like the gold bug types who really hate stocks, I guess, are the Austrian, like the hardcore Austrian economists. I'm seeing that as kind of naive now in a way. You kind of have to split your personal feelings and the economic reality. So it's totally fine to say, I think that the stock market is kind of debased from the reality of how the businesses are performing by and large. And, you know, there's too much intervention. So like the prices aren't fair, or, you know, the way this system's set up is going to increase wealth inequality, which is bad for society, or something like this. Like, you can believe all these things, but still go, I'm going to go long stocks because I'd be stupid not to. But then it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Obviously, if everyone's thinking that, then it kind of goes up forever. But the main issue I see with stocks, I kind of think they will go up, but I don't really want to buy them because I just see it as like, this is so much moral hazard in that space. For example, a lot of countries have pension systems where essentially a chunk of your pay gets directed straight into like stocks, regardless of how businesses are performing. So there's all these things that are happening that essentially put upward pressure on stocks. But then if there's all this upward pressure, then it becomes almost stupid to invest in anything else, right? Which should mean it should go like parabolic.
That's what governments ultimately are trying. It's kind of like a belief-weighted hard fork almost. It's like they're trying to say people who own stocks, they're the true believers, and that we're going to keep rewarding them. We're going to keep rewarding them. They're buying into the government itself in a way. I think that the only way that that really snaps back is for there to be big regime change where you have far left forces gain power and they say, you know, we're going to raise asset taxes. Then you'll see the real crash because society will be reorganized. But I think the way that it's organized now, it's programmed to go up. It's programmed to say any kind of growth, it involves growing the wealth of people that own assets.
Just trying to like unpack this idea a little bit here. I think it's the same in most, you know, countries in the world now, but say in Australia, we have this system where if you have a job, a chunk of your money goes into a pension fund. And then when you don't work anymore, essentially the goal is that most people can live off essentially a stock portfolio, a stock and bond portfolio. What's really interesting about that, in my opinion, is ironically in Australia, it's actually the center left parties that push for increasing the amount of money that your employer has to pay into these systems.
Yeah, exactly. The center left and the center right are both very in favor of stocks going up, number go up.
Yeah.
It gets them elected, and it's safe policy, right? It means that everything kind of works. Think about in Australia too, right? I think you can get a mortgage on 10% down, right? That means that Australia can't let housing fall that fast. Otherwise, everything's screwed. So they do all these things to kind of put safeguards in, put all that in. They're, because of all that leverage and all that wealth effect that they governments have bought into, they've sold this myth, I think, to people that because the asset prices will stay stable, go up, that's how you invest, and therefore that's how you stay, you know, you stay well.
Yes.
Out, right? And
yes. Well, this is exactly my point about the moral hazard effect here, because say initially, if stocks outperformed everything until like the 50s or something, and people like, well, if you buy stocks, you're essentially giving businesses capital, and then those businesses can employ people and they can build things that people want, etc. A very vanilla kind of capitalism best case scenario situation. I like the sound of that. That sounds great. The problem is you want to have some kind of efficient deployment of capital where businesses that are doing well get more money and ones that aren't offering things people want get less. But if you've got these like indexes where and people are forced to put money into the system and it will literally, or like a significant chunk of your population, like the elderly and the disabled essentially, need these stocks values to maintain in order for them to be looked after, so everyone else in the world can, you know, have lower taxes and get on with their life. This becomes like a very big problem, because essentially the stock, there's nothing about a stock historically speaking that had anything to do with ensuring retired people can live until they die. Or
not at all. And same with housing as well, right? I mean, a good example is in Hong Kong during SARS, housing fell like 50% plus. I mean, it's unfathomable today to imagine any market where housing can even fall 30%. Because governments would step in so hard, and that they would buy up mortgages, they would buy up everything, they would lower rates.
I don't mind the stocks getting bidded up insanely, because at least like you don't need stocks to live. But the housing one, personally for me, is something I always find really distasteful, especially in Australia. How, I don't know if this is a bad analogy, but I almost go like, imagine if you did the same thing for food. You said, oh, everyone needs food, so if I like buy all the food, the farms up, and just essentially like make the cost of food higher, then I'll be a genius because I can retire on that forever. Like, is that good?
But if everyone grew food and then government said, I'll always buy your crops at a high price, then people would be like, oh, that's a great government, I'll vote them in. Ultimately, it can't even be analyzed economically. I think it can only be analyzed politically, which is that in these democracies, in these countries where government wants to keep a mandate, the center left, center right, have followed this path of quantitative easing, follow this path of downside volatility smoothening. And as a result of this, I think the people that were the sharpest to realize that this is, in fact, the new reality, they did very well post-2008, right? Because they recognized that all dips were to be bought. You know, anything with no earnings but with high growth is incredibly valuable. And, you know, the people that didn't really buy into this, that were, you know, buying gold, you know, gold still at the same, nearly the same price as it was, you know, back then. And so I think that has only, you know, hardened people's belief that this is the world we live in, and this is what governments are meant to do. Governments are basically built to make sure this keeps happening. And so that currently captures a majority in almost all countries, because even though other people are getting richer than they are, they still feel like they benefit from that system.
Yeah,
and they wouldn't want to see it go down. You know, even if you have only a few hundred K in your retirement, it doesn't mean you want to vote in some far left people that want to reorganize society.
Right.
That want to, or some far right people that want to, you know, radically decrease the monetary base. It's just very scary. People are used to this now. So it's going to be tough. It's very hard to predict how it will ultimately end. I think China recently said that they would sell all U.S. treasuries if there was more escalation of a military kind. Things like that. And, you know, if U.S. rates started to go up substantially, uncontrollably, because there's no buyer of U.S. debt, and the dollar would have weakened substantially, that would also have a lot of knock-on effects about what people assume governments can control. Because right now it's all based on the idea that the U.S. itself can maintain its own stability, which I think is true. But if that were to break down, that could be another way, you know, outside of politics where that system would break down.
Yeah.
Obviously, Bitcoin would do very, very well in that kind of environment.
So. That's a good point. Yeah, when I think about stocks, just compared to cryptocurrency, it just seems incredibly precarious and not straightforward. But then, as I've just said, if you look back over the past decades, you're shooting yourself in the foot if you didn't go long anyway. And as you said, like you can almost the stock market itself is too big to fail in a way. In so many countries now that almost all stops will be pulled to try to hold this thing up. Just one more point on this. Would it be correct to say in Australia, so we have all these people whose retirement is funded by stocks, and so you need the stock prices to go up, so you have like mandatory pension systems and, you know, a whole industry that essentially pushes people to buy these stocks. I just can't help but think, or housing as well, like the housing industry in Australia is ginormous. And there's a whole like media apparatus that encourages Australians to buy houses like there's no tomorrow and to overextend themselves. What seems funny to me is like these things have been like co-opted to have this wealth preservation thing, whereas originally like a house was to, you know, keep you out of the weather and give you like somewhere to go after you've finished working, and stocks, you know, are supposed to be tied to the revenue of a business and the value of a business and the growth potential and et cetera. I can't help but wonder if like potentially one day governments could create a thing that is like the purpose is like this Ponzi scheme essentially, where as long as the population is growing, we pay each other out. I mean, I guess that's what a tax-based pension system was back in the day. Like as long as there's more young people coming up, they can pay taxes to pay a pension to people. It feels like essentially we've moved that onto stocks and housing so we can lower taxes. But I'm not sure that this kind of mirage thing that happens where things aren't clear and we're using things for different purposes than their strict definition. I personally think that like on a long enough timeline, things could get very confused.
Almost really not end in a very good way. I think Australia is an interesting example too, specifically because it's benefited from a 30-40 year boom cycle in commodities. It's benefited from the China growth as well. And I think that there's a lot of assumptions where, you know, I think that if you didn't have the external economy being very strong, so some of these, I mean, Singapore is the same too. It really relies on that external economy being very strong, that globalization being very in vogue for a lot of these assumptions to be true. It's not like the US where we can print our own money and everyone will buy our money anyways, right? We can't do that here in Singapore. Australia can't do that. So I think it means that if the bull market were to stop, like all the assumptions fail at once, right? You see that in the property market, right? There's an assumption that Chinese people would come to Australia and buy in every city and just bid everything up to the moon, to infinity. And like now Chinese people have a hard time getting money out of China. I saw like in a lot of Australian cities, they just give up their deposits. They don't even get it back.
Yeah.
You know, they just forfeit it and they can't buy. You know, so property market, you know, it's weakened in some places, but in the ultra prime, it's still going up because of money printing and because people getting richer. And so I think there's like two contradictory but true statements that will likely happen, which is that the rich will keep getting richer and this will push up asset prices. And at the same time, this wealth inequality bridging out will mean that governments have to think much harder about how do they reach everyone. And so the way that this softens naturally, I think, is that there's some way that they can give this kind of, so like UBI is one thing that people talk about now, a few other these kind of things, where if the governments can give the masses what they want, which is a ability to live their life and afford property and afford housing and start a family and things like that, then it can soften over time. And then they can you know, slowly become more hawkish on on the stock market, right? They can slowly warn. I mean, it's Singapore, we saw that where in 2015, there was a lot of hot money coming in again in 2016. And then the Singapore government said, you know, we're going to raise the stamp duty on foreigners buying. We're going to make it harder. We're going to tighten mortgages, make it harder to get mortgages. And the market fell off a bit, fell off 10, 15%. And then they, you know, and they loosened slightly. And so, like, if the governments wanted, they could manage stocks to be the same price, like, for a year. They could actually probably accomplish this.
Yeah.
And so I think eventually, if they feel like that's a problem, they may try to top off the stock market. And then if it were to dip, they would like buy the dip. So they can basically manage it into a very, very tight range. That seems like an approach that a lot of governments will ultimately take if this stuff resolves relatively safely. And then people don't expect stocks to go up a shit ton every year. But they just say, okay, this is still yielding more than bonds, and this is just another thing you buy. And maybe you're good at the stocks, so you pick the better ones, so you can still outperform.
But right.
I do think there are many ways that it resolves naturally. I think that the consensus there is still not totally broken, but I do think that if it were to go on uncontrollably, then it would be a disaster. I think there are definitely some countries that went into 2008 and made that mistake where they thought this could go on forever, and then just one assumption changes, you know, and then the whole thing falls apart immediately, right?
Yeah.
All the banks got super leveraged, and you don't see that this time. So for some of the naysayers, I do think that they don't recognize that it's quite different from 07, 08, right? Where there's not that bank leverage in the system. There's not that massive leveraging of household finances as well. So.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. It's very, very interesting times we live in. So I've got a few more last questions, a little bit random, so you can kind of take these where you'd like to take them. Just because we were talking about housing, I think it might be funny. You put out this tweet, I think it was a week ago, saying that you can't get a reasonably priced house for $15 million in a lot of cities. Was that just a joke, or were you trying to make some kind of actual point there?
I was kind of trolling him, I guess, but I do think it's true. I mean, I think the amount of money in DeFi or in sushi in particular, it's really not that much, right? It's really not that much money. so like just in here in Singapore, the bungalows, there's a class of bungalows called good class bungalows, and the average price of these is over $30 million. And these are just houses with a plot of at least 0.3 acres.
That's right. What it is. So yeah, that's huge. Quite small.
Not so big. I mean, but Singapore is obviously very expensive, and these have a monetary premium as well because of scarcity. But there's 1,000 of them. So there's 1,000 houses here that are worth around $30 million or more. And so I guess my point is just that I think DeFi is still small. The total value locks are high, but that's, as we all know, it's not that meaningful of a number because a lot of these are just assets people hold anyways. And the actual money that's like in the sushi ETH pool, that's what really matters, right? And that not so big. And even though the fully diluted values are high, it doesn't mean that it's actually a whole lot of money going in and out. So I think that if anything, I was trying to say like this sushi story is not as interesting or is not as, you know, as big and worth arguing a lot about as people say,
you know? This is kind of like I was saying earlier that a lot of people don't realize how small the market cap is, even for Bitcoin is really, if you want to have like serious institutional money coming in or like big funds putting a proportion of their capital in something like Bitcoin, that's just so small. So,
I mean, just another example, right? That tweet about the other day about that water bottle company, the Chinese company, there's $87 billion locked up to buy that IPO, $7 billion US dollars.
Water company.
For a water bottle company. So there's a tremendous amount of real wealth in the normal system, in real estate, in stocks, and all this stuff. So DeFi can grow 1,000 times bigger if it's actually useful and creates value. And if it doesn't, then it will die. But I happen to think that it does have a lot of merit. So I think that... all the battles being fought today over turf and like forking this, forking that, I just think people should keep, you know, keep in mind the big picture that you're trying to go after the big space, right? You're trying to go after the actual world and not, you know, get mired into internal.
I mean, this kind of ties into what I was saying before as well about how if you live in the crypto bubble, you're doing yourself a disservice. I mean, I did that for myself for many years, to be honest. Just write off stocks, write off learning about how big the traditional finance world is. Things like you just said with the water bottle company definitely put things into perspective. But there's no downside to learning about this stuff, because at the end of the day, what it makes you realize is there is still incredible upside potential for cryptocurrency, and that it is still such early days. So we mentioned Peter Thiel earlier. I have a kind of Thielian question. I think this is a thing from 0 to 1. Apparently, he used to ask people when they pitched startups to him, what do you believe about the future to be true that other people don't?
I think that crypto itself, it can grow much bigger than people even imagine. Even the hardest believers, you know, today, because I think right now and throughout crypto, people generally target an X. They target whether 5X or 10X or, you know, maybe 20X, and then they want to take a lot of profit and then live their life. I think I've seen this a lot, and it's generally been the way that the markets have evolved, right? So, but I think that there's this kind of realization, as I see how the space has been evolving this year, is that crypto is on the cusp of answering a lot of very big questions, solving a lot of very big problems. And if it can come within 10% of solving the whole totality of these problems, that it'll be hard to predict how the value accrues and what exactly will go up the most and things like that. But I think that from a zoomed out perspective, there's tremendous value to what's being built here, right? Mm-hmm. Whether that's decentralized money that people use to save, or whether that's a whole new way to build the foundations of the internet. I think that this, I mean, as much as we're already bull tards on crypto, on Twitter and so on and so forth, I think that, if you see the institutional involvement now, where a lot of money is going into these newer VCs that are raising follow-on funds, and I think their LP base, they actually see these changes and they wonder how is the world going to be different, right? You see this, tacitly with how Square is now worth more than Goldman and PayPal is worth more than the next biggest bank, and there's a lot of these foundational shifts. But then it's like, okay, well, how is PayPal, you know, what will PayPal be worth in 100 years, 50 years, 10 years, 5 years? What will these companies be worth? What's their moat? And then you think about, you know, if crypto people get their act together and offer a real user experience, is that not a superset of what's already being offered to people, right? Do people even need a bank account in the future? Do they even need this, you know? And then I think there's a lot of subversive stuff that will happen because of that too, but people won't quite know how to deal with it, right? Even think about taxes right now. Pretty sure no one pays tax in DeFi, right? These individual users. I mean, I think too, if you imagine like everyone's getting their salary via crypto on DeFi, like everyone's getting their goods and services being paid. How is VAT going to be charged? How is GST going to be charged? These kinds of things are actually a lot more subversive than people realize at first. And I think it's very much a paradigm shift. So I think that right now people are still focused on like gains, and they're still focused on like what is the next 5X or what is the next 2-3X. But I think that there are 1,000Xs in this space now. And that's not, let's say, too late per se, because I think now is actually when it's starting to show its real value.
Yeah, so that's a great segue to the last question of this interview, which was going to be, what would you say to someone who, you know, wants to get into finance or trading now, or someone who's begun recently and really wants to level up? So I guess you're thinking it's not too late. A lot of people's, see a lot of people that I've been talking to about crypto for the past, you know, like 6+ years, they often say like, oh, it's too late, surely. Try to explain that it's definitely not. But yeah, what would you say to someone in the same shoes?
Yeah, I think that the way that numbers work in our minds, we'll always think it's too late because almost certainly the prices now will be higher than the prices when you first heard about it, right? So I remember like
it's SNX. It's a really great point, yeah.
SNX, I was shilled SNX at 2 cents, right? To be able to buy it 20x higher, 30x higher than when you first heard about it, that's very uncomfortable for a lot of people. Mm. But it's ultimately just the structure of all markets, right? It just means that it's getting adoption. It also means that you were right to have looked into it earlier. So I think that process of seeing numbers go up without them enjoying it, then making them think it's late, I mean, that's just the nature of the world itself. And that'll be your experience in all asset classes too, not just crypto. So I think that don't let that kind of it's almost a behavioral flaw of people, which is to think linearly instead of convex, to fool you into thinking about opportunities. Try to evaluate like pure principles. If you're a more longer term investor, try to figure out what you believe and then form a portfolio that's in line with those beliefs, and then be willing to be wrong, right? So if you're wrong, you're going to lose money on that, but it's okay because you would have put your bets where you've made them. There's a really good Novogratz video I saw a few years ago that kind of imprinted this on me, which was to say, he said like a lot of good traders, they're bullish, but they're scared to be long. So they'll sell calls, or they're bullish, but then they'll hedge.
Right.
And so when they're right, they don't make what they're supposed to make. And then when they're wrong, they lose the same as they lose. So they don't focus enough on making sure when they're really right, they make the most, right? And that's actually how a lot of the big money in the space ends up being made, because when you do the research in, you know, deep in the weeds, and you figure out that this is, you know, what's good. I mean, there are people that made, you know, 30, 40x on some DeFi coins this year, and to be able to hold that through at the 30x and even buy more as it goes up, you need to kind of have a thesis, right? Like, you can't just be trading the number, because if you trade the number, then by definition, it'll go to some take profit. And then maybe you'll even go short because, you know, you're just trading numbers. So I would say, as tempting as it is to trade just the number, always try to do fundamental analysis. Like, always try to think about, what do you like most in the space? What could you see playing out very well? Because when things play out well in any space, the upside is much, much bigger than the downside. So that's where the true wealth creation is happening. I think on the sort of more intraday trading side too, I think that can also be a good approach for some people, but it needs to be very disciplined. It needs to be very systematic. So keep a journal and keep a good way of analyzing your own performance and just figuring out, like, you know, am I actually improving? Am I capturing opportunities? You know, do I have a cycle? You know, am I in the markets more to gamble, or am I in it to try to capture an edge? You know, what is my edge? I think these are all tough questions. And just treat it like a sport, right? So treat it like something that you would try to master over time, as opposed to a recreation. I think too often traders, when they start, they think of it as like something to kill time, or something like a video game, you know, but it's actually much more like a sport, I think.
Yeah. One thing I've noticed recently is, especially with a lot of these DeFi things like farming or whatever, it is a competitive game, really. It's super gamified now. But that is an excellent answer to that question. I wish someone had told me that point about how there was a line you had there: the price is probably going to be higher when you're considering buying than when you first heard of it. And that is a terrible psychological thing, because if it's the other way as well, I just realized, if the price goes down, then usually, or sometimes, you might decide not to keep looking into it. You think it's done. In that case, then you miss out on 100% of opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thank you so much for your time. This has been a really, really, really good interview. I think people are going to love this one.
I really enjoyed speaking on it. Thanks for having me.